My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Anna Samolova's philosophy is that an artist is a cultural worker first and foremost. By utilizing tools and strategies related to digital media and commercial photography, her work explores notions of environmentalism, consumerism, and the picturesque. She's actively opening up conversations about climate anxiety and the future of humanity, as well as questioning the pictured world we occupy. Her practice is one that is rooted in collaboration, understanding that nothing is built in isolation.
Another illusion that I think needs to be dismantled is the singularity behind an artist's career. There's no such thing as a solo artist, right? There's a whole team there.
I'm Jen Fletcher, and this is The Messy Truth, Conversations on Photography. Anna is a Russian-American artist who moves between observational photography, studio practice, and installation. Her ongoing project, Flood Zone, has been exhibited around the world and manifested as a book in 2019. It was recently shortlisted for the Dorschbos Photography Foundation Prize. In her new book, Floridas, we see her work in conversation with Walker Evans. Anna lives and works in Miami.
I grew up in Russia, I feel like with the work, Landscape Sublime. I probably have absorbed the best of it. Russian avant-garde was the inspiration. Alexander Exter, Natalia Goncharova, going to museums. So that aesthetic and approach and the philosophy about an artist being a cultural worker first, you know, and formal elements of art are secondary to the function, I think is in my DNA as an artist. Yeah, so that was my beginning. And early on, I enrolled in environmental design program at the Russian State University for the Humanities in Moscow. So that was 2001. And to document my physical constructions of various proposed sites for my environmental design program, I had to pick up a camera. So I learned photography as this sort of applied utilitarian tool.
That's so interesting, thinking about photography in the context of that kind of tool. I guess I'm so fascinated by your practice on a number of levels, and one of them being that the sense of continuum within your work is ever more present than I find with a lot of artists. You know, there's this real sense of building and transforming, and you've kind of created a grammar within your practice, which is very unique to the way you see and interact with the world. And as you mentioned then, Landscape Sublime is where things officially began, which is this incredible, captivating series of kind of sculpted landscapes born from user-shared image archives. I'd love to hear a little bit about your initial intentions with that project and how it unraveled.
Thank you. And thank you for seeing the continuity. It's not the only opinion on the work. You know, I often get questions, how did you jump from one thing to the other so radically? And, you know, the project became somewhat known, the Landscape Sublime project, I mean, and it's all studio-based sets that I construct out of user-shared images that I find online in copyright-free archives. I download them, I print them out, and I reconstitute this somewhat cubist environments. And then I re-photograph them. And so the final object, I guess, is still this flat print. So it goes from this sort of ephemeral online presence into a physical world as a two-dimensional print. Then it becomes a three-dimensional set, very much inspired by Alexandra Exter, her theater proposals. And then I re-photograph them and print them out. And the idea, you know, it's a bit of a gestural metaphor for constructed worlds and worlds constructed of images and our perception of this world based on the images that we see. And of course, now it's a difficult time for me to talk, but in retrospect, I realized that a lot of it, you know, in this initial impetus for the work came out of this acute awareness of the world that's represented through images and propaganda images being a part of it. Social media is a different world. You know, the images I find, I found initially were on a popular sort of amateur photographers and semi-pros and some institutions even that used to be the go-to before, you know, smartphones became popular. There's a different kind of images, but nonetheless, it was a reflection on certain places that I could easily imagine in my mind based on images that I've seen them alone and never from this firsthand experience. So the metaphor is for this kind of construct in our collective memory of places and cultures that we might have not experienced firsthand. And so this sort of questioning of the pictured world.
I love this work so much. And I think there's so much baked into it that continues to shift and evolve. And I love the fact that it was born out of Flickr in some ways, or kind of references Flickr, because I feel like so many of us kind of began in our teens, you know, having a relationship with Flickr. It's surprising how often it comes up in people's photographic history. But I guess, I mean, there's loads of things I want to jump into. One being, for me, I think I've seen a video of you making some of the work, and it's so physical, like you're constantly testing and experimenting with these assemblages. I wondered if you could talk about the physicality of your practice then and how it felt to be in that moment.
Yeah, that's a great question. It comes from, I think, from several inclinations. On the one hand, on the formal side of things, I prefer not to pre-design these compositions. So I really just build them as a set from empty, you know, from blank canvas, essentially, off that initial white backdrop. Actually, in most of them, it's not white. There's this gridded plastic. And the backstory of that is my first artist residency was in Illinois. I was given a space by the window, and it was a huge window that had to be protected from tornadoes. So the plastic you see in the background is actually hurricane / tornado protection on a window. And it was done with daylight. All the sets were done with daylight, but I thought it was an important inclusion. And then prints I made to scale of that. So the scale of that grid remains consistent. And then I kept bringing that backdrop with me everywhere. So since 2013, I've had it. It's absolutely joyful. Well, you know, I guess there's more than joy in that. There is a bit of an act of destruction, perhaps, with the prints, you know, being folded. And then remember cut with kitchen knife. There's a bit of that, of course, which reflects the tumultuous world, you know, and Dada lived through a period no less dramatic than ours. So I think just the act of collaging, assembly and disassembly and cutting is perhaps reflective of chaos as well. And then trying to make sense out of that chaos by constructing a more cohesive composition. And I do that by just adding those elements to the set, no sketch. I try to keep them playful. So it's both. And there's quite a bit of movement involved. So with every element, I have to come up to the set and then move things, which then results in now the separate branch of this project, which is time-based. And these are time-lapse videos of the process that are now their independent own pieces, I guess. And I just uploaded them as NFTs. So there's that in the project.
Yeah, and you mentioned earlier that you collate all these different open license images. And it made me think in some ways you have these kind of silent collaborators, both the work that you're drawing from and reimagining, but also I feel like with this project, the work is particularly activated by leaning on the viewer's kind of collective imagination and how we have been programmed culturally to have these visualizations of what these different elements in the landscape are described as and mean to us, even if we haven't been there, like you said. And I was just curious if you think about the work in a collaborative context.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Even though authorship is sort of the least interesting aspect of it for me, because they are not appropriations. You know, I didn't really want to investigate the whole idea of authorship. I was mainly positively intrigued by this democratic potential of photography, and also, you know, this overabundance of images coming out of just the natural accumulation of the same kinds of depictions. So there's this pattern and typology that I was interested in when I began, and now it evolved in all kinds of other subjects beyond straight up landscape. So there are several works from 2020 where I would gather images of various sort of observers, I guess, records of climate phenomena, climate change consequences. You know, there were all these wildfires going out west in the States, San Francisco, and then Australia. I focused on the United States. And then there were records of floods in New York City, and the news came out that the city is now qualifying for a subtropical zone. So a collage for me was also a means to process this anxiety. And I think the very dense compositions of the later stages of this project are telling of the perhaps less peaceful, I guess, approach, and the density and sort of the elimination of negative space, and I just really wanted to show the multiplicity of those testimonies, essentially citizen journalism that I was assembling together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, you're weaving in so many different ideas and methodologies within this project, which I think is why it's so generative and there are so many different ways in. It's interesting to hear you talk about your own personal anxiety around, you know, everything going on with climate, because I was curious about that, because as we kind of go on to talk about other projects you've been working on, that is, you know, the looming and ever-present sense of climate change and its impact on our lives is a main thread through the work. And I was curious as what it's been like for you over the last decade of thinking about that and feeling that yourself as an artist and processing that and what that means for you.
Yeah, absolutely. And I realize, you know, the overarching theme is climate anxiety more than anything. Landscape Sublime, there were before this project, my thesis work was focused on industrial agriculture in Midwest, where I was studying. But instead of while I have produced a short documentary about it, I thought it felt too didactic and frankly not effective for me. There are better documentary filmmakers. So I went a different way and concentrated on early propaganda images that sort of convinced the public that industrial agriculture was the way to go and nothing bad would come out of that kind of practice. And the whole shift that happened in just the last few decades towards industrialized agriculture and factory farms and elimination of small family farms. So I focused on posters and advertisements, different affiliated companies, and I interpreted them in a series of sort of semi-abstract collages. So Landscape Sublime began after. And then with the recent images, like I mentioned, these were documentations of wildfires and this orange skies in San Francisco in 2020, something that kept coming up on my phone. And so in this flood of images, I attempted to sort of make sense, but at the same time to show just the amount, just the number of those records. Very recently, I have also started photographing various full-size, sort of like life-scale renderings of new developments throughout Miami and other cities. And that sort of branch of the project is called New Developments. And again, it's like twice removed from reality rendering, yet it seems like the world is heading towards that kind of image, this sort of meta of itself. And then with the flood zone, so the most direct approach, it also began from the interest in the existing images throughout the city where I live in Miami.
I'm excited to talk about flood zone. So that you spent 3 years photographing Miami, Florida, and three other states, exploring these kind of subtler signs of climate change and what awaits people who live along the shorelines in the states. And the images are so disarming. They're mesmerizing, actually. And it's really interesting to me the ways in which they communicate and talk about and tap into our kind of shared psychological state and how, you know, the impending reality of climate anxiety, as you said, impacts us all. I guess I'd love to hear about your intentions with this work and what the process was like moving from kind of, you know, being in a space with Landscape Sublime where you were fully in control of the process to some degree to more hunting out kind of these ready-made images on the streets of Miami.
Yeah. So with Landscape Sublime, which I began in 2013, the sublime part comes from, you know, it's a aesthetic category. German philosophers, we have Kant, right? Schopenhauer, who used images, who used examples from nature to illustrate the categories, such as the, you know, picturesque, the beautiful, and the sublime. So sublime is something that is so grand, it can overwhelm an individual. And then moving to Miami in 2016, I noticed not only the proliferation of the sort of idealized images of Miami all throughout the city, but also, like you said, the strange signs of water where it shouldn't be, right? Mm. So salt water, I didn't know it was salt water initially, coming out from the drains several times a year and not necessarily rain related, which I learned later is the phenomenon called sunny day flooding. It's related to tides. And this is where you have to go hide your car, park it elsewhere. There's a map of locations now where sunny day flooding occurs. And so this was a learning process, but initially, I was drawn to, again, images within the city. So there's a whole thread throughout the project and my book of photographs of billboards that are all over the city. And, you know, my curiosity about those images, convincing that this is a worthy place for real estate investment, for tourism. But then the whole history of Florida is intertwined. It's really dependent on those images, those idealized fantasy renderings of Florida. I think it was I found on eBay like one of the early postcards saying Florida, a perfectly fine, safe state. Occasional summer storms, and of course hurricanes have been here historically. It's just now the effects are exacerbated by rising sea levels. Yeah, so it began through this permanent interest in images within this urban landscape, and then just quiet observations walking the street, which was a new practice for me entirely. I have not really done observational photography before. There's a lot of walking.
I bet. How did you sustain yourself with all that walking? And also that act of surrendering to chance to some degree, because I guess, you know, you never knew if you were going to find something.
Yeah, with the Landscape Sublime project, this was perhaps a means to understand the world from those images' perspective. And then with the flood zone, I realized I need to get out of the studio and process this relocation through, you know, there's a bit of a detachment still through my lens, but also in the most direct and immediate and intimate way, which can only be accomplished by walking these streets. And it's very hot. So that's most of my images are taken in the morning. There's another project called Breakfasts. And this is where I would, and they coincide, where I would wake up and actually I could have breakfast now because I left my teaching job. And so my mornings were suddenly my own and not in the classroom. So I could have my coffee and simple breakfast with photo books. And I would get inspired and go out and just photograph.
Maybe this is me being too romantic, but I imagine it must have been a really interesting way to get to know the city as a new person when you first arrived.
Yes, and it's a very, for lack of a better word, exotic place for me. You know, I come from a very different climate than in the States. I lived in Midwest, in the Chicago area, and then in Northeast, in Western Massachusetts, upstate New York. So this was very new and very strange, and it's, of course, you know, primary industry is tourism, real estate. So this was a way to understand the place without any preconceived agenda on what I wanted to photograph. So I just let myself explore, and it was speculative. I knew I had to keep working on something, but at that point, I felt like the Sublime project was becoming too comfortable for me. And so I needed that push, and the photo books provided inspiration, and the city itself provided a fascinating subject. And then I met other artists. I think you had Rose here on the podcast, Rosemary Cromwell. Yeah. She's a friend, and we actually shared a studio here, and she comes from a very different approach in photography. So it was great to meet her and try it out. This was an experiment.
Yeah, I think what I find so fascinating about the work is how it kind of builds on some of your visual strategies as an artist, thinking about playing with color and light and form and sculptural elements and images within images. But you're also kind of foregrounding this kind of emotional connection with the viewer. And you, unlike a lot of dialogue around climate change, climate anxiety, you resist doom and gloom in the way that it's kind of perpetuated, and you resist the trauma of the depiction of climate change, and instead kind of drawing people in through kind of atmosphere and curiosity. And I wondered if you could talk a little bit about that decision, because it's very distinct and quite vital to your practice.
Yeah, oh, that's a good one. I knew even about a month or two into it when some initial ideas were already shaping in my mind, and then with some further research, you know, some books that I picked up, just to familiarize myself with the situation, you know, the environmental situation here, my work has always been concerned with a notion of place and our perception of places through images, and of course, environmentally concerned. But I wanted to steer clear of this kind of didactic narrative. And plus, I don't come into photography from reportage, you know, so I'm kind of resistant as a viewer and as a photographer to drama and dramatization, which I find exploitative of the audience. And with the very sensitive subject that is already becoming a bit of a, you know, a bit of a cliche. We can picture the kind of climate change photography that is available, right, and easily accessible, which has become a trope. And of course, with the Landscape Sublime project, I'm addressing precisely that, among other things. So I wanted to find my own language and to show this firsthand, you know, insider's perspective. The first exhibition I saw when I moved to Miami was actually Bernice Abbott Route 1. And it inspired me to pursue it in this way. And then eventually, I think the motifs evolved. And you can see the recurrence of some of them throughout the project and the book. And it's really, you know, it's really, observational photography is the art of selection. I photograph a lot. I don't carry a tripod. It's a simple camera. It's not large format or anything, even though they're cropped to 4:5 ratio. I just prefer it on the aesthetic level. But it's very low tech. And the focus is really the subject. And the tools are minimal. So I think that probably defines the formal characteristics of the project.
And tell me a little bit about that editing process, because I imagine that must be where you get those interesting surprises and the unexpected could happen when you start to see the conversations emerge between the images.
Oh, yeah. That's another part of it. So this is where the pairings of images were laid out later. Initially, I think in singular images, I'm mainly sort of exhibitions and wall. I think of wall first. I think in prints, because I'm a printmaker. And I think in certain scale, there's a specific size to most of my images, and they're fairly large scale. So I think architecturally, and I think in singular views. And that's why I realized about a year into it that I will need an external editor, because this is not the skill I have. And I already was plotting a possible book. I even went to an artist residency, and I brought a small printer with me, determined to lay out the book. And this was in 2017. And I spent 3 weeks there pinning up those tiny postcard size images on the wall every single day, all day. And just continuing to be disappointed with the layout. And then I thought, okay, I can't do it all. And so then I outsourced the layout of the book to the brilliant editor, David Campany, who then did all the pairings. It was collaborative, but I also trusted him with you know, the sequence after learning the hard way that I'm unable to do that. I can do it with other people's work, with my students when I used to teach, but with my own art, it's just a challenge that I didn't want to continue taking on. So the sequence was made by an external editor in the book.
I mean, isn't it powerful though to admit where collaboration can benefit your practice? I feel like we're so obsessed with trying to do everything ourselves. And there's already a massive undertaking in the conceptualizing and making of the work and all the trust and energy that goes into putting ourselves through that process of making, that it's in some ways quite liberating, I think, to you know, to open the door when we may need support on stuff. And I was curious to ask about your relationship with David, because we'll talk about your new book in a minute, but you've collaborated with him several times, and it seems to be a really generative relationship for both of you.
Yeah, with the flood zone, it made my life so much easier. And then, like you said, it's a creative act too. So, for that reason, when I saw the results, I found them inspiring and energizing, and I wanted to keep going with this kind of collaborative approach. And initially, you know, I'd like to think that even with Landscape Sublime, the decision to never sketch those compositions prior is a very conscious decision, of course. I wanted the images and this act of staging to lead me where the composition needs to be. And basically, you know, sometimes it's 3 hours, sometimes it's a day, sometimes it's several days. The only way for me to know when it's done is when it gets worse. When it's starting to get worse, this is where I knew that I need to let it go and just leave it alone. And the same with the flood zone. It would have never happened had I had any kind of preliminary, you know, list or any sort of visuals in mind. I knew what I did not want to do. I knew I didn't want to do some sort of like a helicopter reporter approach, even though there are a couple of aerial images because Florida is so flat and they help to see that side of things. But I just let the place lead me. And I'd let the city itself dictate and sort of not really dictate, but more of a inspire the color palette, which is quite distinct there. And I just wanted to remove myself, I guess, and any kind of style from what I thought was more interesting, which is the subject. I just wanted to look sort of most authorless it could possibly be, like the images made themselves. And then the collaboration was so productive because then I let go of my control of that sequence. And I did not want to make any kind of distinct particular narrative. It can be interpreted in several ways. There are no, you know, chapters in the book.
It's so interesting to hear how much the unknowingness is a fuel in your practice. And what I've been so, you know, in preparing for our conversation, I've watched a lot of talks that you've done over the years. And it was so interesting to me how you have such specific intention with where, like, what you're trying to say and what you're trying to grapple with, but you don't know necessarily how you're going to get there. And you're very open, as you just said, to that process being guided by other forces. And you seem to walk that balance so well and with such confidence. I'm curious how you've cultivated that confidence, or whether it doesn't feel like confidence, it's just inherent to who you are and how you move through the world. But it's just so interesting to me because I think so many people grapple with surrender and knowing what parts of your practice you need to kind of let be and where to guide and mold and shape, if you like. I don't know if that made sense.
Yeah, totally. Speaking of guides, and then letting go of any preconceived ideas. And letting the place lead you. I don't know if inspire, I don't particularly love the word inspire. I think there are other forces there. I read, and then photography is just one of many of my inspirations. As much of a nerd as I am about photography, Rebecca Solnit, one of my favorite writers, and her field guide to getting lost, was a great book that that came into my life right in the beginnings of this project. And then later, well, I picked up some nonfiction on the environmental subject. So those books helped with some locations, but as it tends to be, and because I'm not a photojournalist, you know, I'm not obliged to deliver specific locations, you know, to photograph specific locations. So it's sort of this preliminary map, and I have lots of maps around Florida and there's Louisiana, other states that I photograph. But most of my images are taken in between those locations. And it's on those long walks where something more interesting than the initial flag on my map happens. And sometimes it's really minimal, but more telling. You know, the metaphor is stronger than something that was literal that I could have photographed. So then I gravitate towards the metaphor, and I abandoned the, you know, in your face testimony to the phenomenon that I'm trying to address.
You're listening to The Messy Truth, Conversations on Photography.
You mentioned then imposter syndrome, and I guess I'm curious to ask you about it because, you know, it's something we all grapple with, but you have had such an amazing trajectory in the art world over the last few years in what is, you know, I don't like speaking generalizations, but quite a short period of time. You've achieved so much. You know, you've exhibited all over the world. You've got a number of incredible acclaimed books under your belt. How do you deal with those moments of imposter syndrome?
Good question. It's just by working more. I had this funny conversation at a small bookshop in New York a few months ago where I was trying to initiate a signing for the upcoming book. You know, and I said, yeah, I know you haven't heard of me, but actually I've been around for a long time. It's been over a decade that I've been working on the subject. No, it's really like over 15 years that I've been working on it. I've stayed quiet and I'm sort of off the grid, you know, living in Miami, which is a bit of this frontier. Of course, we have this Miami Beach Art Basel happening once a year, and the tents arrive and then they're here for a week and then they leave. And then what you're left with is your own small community, which has been supportive. And I met some great people here. But it is, you know, relative to like Los Angeles and New York City, is a lot quieter. And I realized that this kind of peace and lack of distraction allowed for this very gentle pace that I needed for the Flood Zone project. That kind of put me on this map, I suppose. Even though, you know, with the Landscape Sublime, there were exhibitions and there was even this independent publication in 2016, and there has been even some press early on. I will never forget when I was standing at my teacher desk at a community college where I was teaching in Illinois in a small town. And then an email from the New Yorker arrived, you know, how did they find me? So photography has this tendency to travel far and wide. I think had I been a painter, it would have been harder, but because of its reproducibility, right? And its effectiveness in whatever format, print or digital format, photography took me this far, and it's a thrill. Of course, I'm in love with the medium, you know, and with its history. The reality is that I work all the time. And so the little conversation in the bookshop where I said, yeah, I'm sort of off the grid, but you know, I raised a kid and I've been around, and it's a different timeline for women too. I have an 11-year-old son. So that took quite a bit of time.
Yes, that's a lot of work. That often goes unseen. It's interesting to me, you mentioned then about, you were kind of talking around the conditions of what we need to make our practice. And you mentioned, you know, you needed that focused time in Miami to begin the work. And it's something that I was talking to Charlotte Cotton about a few episodes ago. And this idea that, this tension between the places where we feel like we need to be for our practice to thrive, often big urban centers with a big art scene, but actually they can be really, they don't work for everybody. Essentially, they can be really distracting and really disruptive when you need a certain stillness or I don't know, whatever quality you're looking for, a certain aspect of space to be able to thrive in your mode of making. And it's so interesting, and I don't think we talk about it that much. I think there's, especially young people, they feel so much pressure to be in London or New York or LA, and there's so much more happening in these smaller communities. There's so much to be said for figuring out the conditions you need to make the best work you can make, rather than worry about kind of following
the sort of guaranteed, or I guess the presumed,
presumed
sure path.
Yeah, exactly.
There's this, you know, and in the States, there's a certain trajectory too that can sort of assure your position, your placement maybe in this art world. It's not the best association with the word anymore, is there? It's a bit tainted. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I had my own path. One of my favorite writers who contributed a short story for this newest book, Lauren Groff, I drove out to meet her in Central Florida, and she's this best-selling author, you know, New York Times bestseller, just brilliant, brilliant writer, fiction. I rarely read fiction, but I was recommended her book, Short Stories, Florida. And so I was just completely fascinated by her language and her imagination. That was a very inspiring is not the word again. You know, it underestimates the effect literature has on me, and especially Groff's fiction. So I drove out to meet her, and we had a conversation and over coffee. And she said, "Yeah, Florida. You know, it's good to be in resistance to a place you live in. You can't. An artist cannot be too comfortable. Mm. You can't. Yeah, yeah." And then, you know, I came here. I did not have the resources to enter like an Ivy League university. So I was in Midwest in a smaller university that provided me a full-time assistantship. And then I taught digital photography in exchange for my MFA. And then it was 6 years of teaching community college. 3 years of community college. And then another year teaching at a college, but undergraduate teaching. And then it was this long journey to where I'm finally doing this full time. What I've been wanting to do my entire life.
Yeah.
But it took quite some time. It took 15 years to arrive at this point.
Yeah, it is a journey. That's exactly it, isn't it? And this, you know, that's one of the big drivers of this entire podcast is bringing more transparency to the journey, because I feel like, you know, we're all encouraged to make out that it happened overnight, you know, and everything came so easy. And there's so much unseen blood, sweat and tears that often, you know, enable somebody to get to where they are. So thank you for sharing that. I really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I think it's really important, you know, and I wish back then, you know, as a student that, or it's all students, be aware that this is not an overnight thing. And it happens overnight for some people. You see very young names, right? And those like major biennials and so forth. But for the most part, it's all these hours that you put in, right? And all these friends absolutely. That you make along the way. And another illusion that I think needs to be dismantled is the singularity behind an artist's career. There's no such thing as a solo artist, right? There's a whole team there.
An ecosystem.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And again, network has this as a word. I feel like it belongs more to business than to art. But essentially, that's what it is. I mean, it's your friends who put you in those early shows, right? It's your friends who write those texts. You know, my first book, Landscape Sublime Book, was published by a friend that I made when I was giving a talk. And then we're still very much in touch. Right. So it's these long-term collaborators that you accumulate over time. And it's this very much an ecosystem. And it's not like this solo artist. Yes, my name is on this book, but there's also this whole paragraph of acknowledgments in the back.
Yeah, it's interesting to think about the lineage of a career and all of those different connecting points that are sometimes, like you said, seemingly so everyday, like meeting somebody at a talk, that actually build into something that can transform and change your work and your practice in really exciting ways. I want to make sure we talk about your new book, because Florida's is a really interesting project that you've been working with, again with David Campney, and it sees your images in dialogue with Walker Evans, which is really fascinating to see how you both kind of layer surface and enable deeper truths to emerge about Florida and this tension between its image versus its reality. And you've paid homage to Evans before in some of your images, and I wondered if you could talk a little bit about what captivates you about his work.
I think it's this the sense of authorlessness that I brought up prior. Mm-hmm. It's hyper focus on the subject, and that's personal taste, but it's lack of photo shticks. I can't phrase it better. It's void of all these dramatic photo tools. You know, you barely see some kind of extreme shallow depth of field, or, you know, some whatever shadow play. I can't quite put a finger on all the shticks, but I think you can picture them, you know. And sometimes a work is all about form and no content, and I'm content first kind of a photographer. And so that was the initial appeal. The other thing is his very wide roster, right? And just a huge grasp on the kinds of subjects, you know, that his lens is aimed at, from, you know, from portraits to urban landscape. The one thing he's not done much of is probably natural landscape, although interestingly in Florida he actually attempted that, was that Mangrove Coast book illustrations. So they're just some straight up landscapes there. So in terms of just the genres, it seems like he could do it all and not limit himself to just a narrow list of subjects. Or, you know, something that really annoys me these days with the professionalization, I guess, in the arts, is that this whole like branding, well, what kind of photographer, you know, what kind of artist are you? And of course, if you go from my, you know, it was just for the first impression between Landscape Sublime and say Florida, so Flood Zone, there might be nothing in common, but it's all connected for me. So with him, he made paintings in Florida that few people know about, and they're included in the book. And then seeing the parallels between those paintings and his, you know, his usual black and white images, but also color images, Polaroids, I found fascinating.
Yeah, I think for me, after, this may sound strange, but after living through a pandemic, there's something even more resonant about the passing of time and what changes and what remains, which was a really big theme for me in this book, which kind of plays out beautifully. And I wondered if you discovered anything new about yourself while working on this project and just, yeah, having that dialogue with another photographer from another era.
Something about myself. I did. Well, it affirmed my love for photography and for adventure. There's many road trips in this book. And at different times, I had different Evans's biographies with me on those road trips. I have my bicycle attached, you know, so I dispatch in a place. And then I ride around on my bicycle. And then I read a book after daylight hours and with my feet in pain. And then there was Svetlana Alper's great book, again, Walker Evans's biography that inspired another trip. And then what did I realize about myself? That I love places, new places, familiar places, and that I could photograph any place. I became a lot more confident throughout the 4 years of photographing for this project.
That's amazing. Okay, so I've got a couple of quick fire questions for you. First quickfire question, how do you deal with self-doubt?
Robert Rauschenberg, one of my favorite artists ever, said just work, you know, it's in the process. You don't wait for inspiration. So what is doubt? You know, it's doubting whether you can do it, doubting whether you just show up and you work. And so that's my, again, goes back to my philosophy that I adopted from one of those, you know, revolutionary artists back in Russia. The avant-garde people who said, you're a cultural worker, just work. There's no doubt. There's when you have to show up and you just believe, you just trust the process.
I love that. That's very powerful. How did success change your work?
Well, that's funny. I don't, you know, they define success. When I'm happy with my work, I'm happy with my work. And I don't put out things that I'm not happy with. I did become more confident. You know, I feel like I love commissions, actually. You know, when somebody brings up a place, and then I know I can approach it in my way, and I'll find things, again, by letting go of any preconceived idea. So I trust in my process now. And I think, well, a success, whatever that is not instruction. I wish I could spend more time actually making work, because success in terms of, you know, exhibitions and publications, it comes with increased time spent on the administration of all of that. So I'm trying to find some balance with that. And I think I'm going to have like an automated reply on my emails saying, I'm just shooting today. You know, because in this whole like digital world of, when do you reply to email? You have to reply within 24 hours or 48 yeah. hours. And then I feel like most of my emails are just beginning with apology now. I need to move away from that pattern.
I'm really fascinated to ask you this next one, but what does art enable you to do that perhaps a different discipline wouldn't have?
Oh, interesting. Well, it's the best. There's nothing better than this, and I've always wanted to do that since I remember myself. It just took a long time to actually be able to do this full time and have it sustainable. You know, when I have these five galleries that support me and institutions and the publisher, so all of that really helps. But it took this entire time to build that, and so I see no alternative. That's what I've always wanted to do.
And you've had such a vibrant career so far. Has there been anything you've had to unlearn along the way?
Oh, yes, actually. I did. I had to unlearn to just sit around and wait for things to come on their own. And it's a balance now. Things do come on their own. I can't complain at all. But I'm also actively seeking collaboration. And I've learned that from other freelancers from all kinds of fields, and photojournalists who make pitches. So I don't make pitches. I'm not a photojournalist. But there are things I've learned from that. It's just it's a different approach. So I've learned not to just be apathetic. And then I directed all the energy that I was spending on teaching and preparation and grading onto my own practice. And so I realized that, you know, practice is separate from my self, even, you know, my ego, whatever it is. It needs to be nurtured and it needs to be advanced. So I took on a more active approach.
And do you think photographs still have the power to shift thinking or consciousness?
Oh, absolutely. I wouldn't be doing it otherwise. Absolutely. It's not just art, right? This is a successful medium. It is the most accessible medium. It's the most realistic looking, at least, right? Even documentary style photography that I do. And it can travel so far. I mean, it's incredible to see even the Flood Zone project covered in so many languages, I lost count, and the resonance it had. So that really keeps me going.
So to finish up, I wanted to ask you the question that I ask everybody at the end of the show. What matters more to you, the process of making the work or the final image?
The final image, actually. I'm not going to give up on the process, but oftentimes a very difficult image to achieve, right, that took lots of effort, whatever, you know, destination, location, scouting, in the end could be disappointing. And then it's not worth including. And it happened to me way too many times. And there were also too many instances of me going out and then getting three images in 1 hour, 2 hours that would end up in a book or a show. So it's just, again, I trust the process, but in the end, it's the final result that matters.
Well, thanks so much, Anna. It's been so great to talk to you. I really appreciate you coming on the show.
Thank you. Thank you. It's been my pleasure. And I'm really thrilled about the upcoming show in London.
Thanks for listening to The Messy Truth. You can find more information about today's guests in the show notes. Theme music is Change by Judd Greenstein from the album Awake, and design is by Ruby White. You can follow updates on the podcast on my Instagram at Jem Fletcher or subscribe to my newsletter at jemfletcher.com. Feel free to leave a review on Apple Podcasts.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hi, I'm Megan Rinks.
And I'm Melissa D. Montz.
And like every other person with access to a microphone, we started a podcast.
On Mondays, we release Don't Blame Me, which is an advice podcast where listeners call in and we share our thoughts on situations such as what to do if you're going to your boyfriend's family function and you haven't told him that you previously slept with both his twin brothers.
Then on Thursdays, we release our podcast, But Am I Wrong?, where we ethically gossip about pop culture, politics, our lives, and your lives. Listeners write in and we tell them if they're wrong or right in a situation. Are you the hero or the villain?
On Tuesdays and Fridays, we throw in a little something extra as well.
Well, something, something. We strive to create a community grounded in activism, mental health, and inclusivity. Think of us as like your blunt, honest friends who give you advice that you need to hear, not what you want to hear. But we're also always rooting for your success. What we lack in credentials, we make up for in
opinions.
We do that in every episode too.
We're professional unprofessionals, so if you're looking for a new slate of podcasts to add to your routine, we're here for you.
Acast recommends.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.